So loving kindness practice is sometimes known by its Buddhist word metta, which means translated as kindness or loving kindness. It's closely connected to the word for friendship, mitta. And it's one of the very fundamental Buddhist practices, and it often goes hand in hand with the mindfulness practice that we mostly focus on here in Palo Alto. I know that many Westerners, including myself, when they first get introduced to loving kindness meditation, will have some negative reaction to it. And maybe it seems artificial, it seems a little bit too saccharine, it seems maybe unrealistic, maybe it feels like it's an avoidance of what's really true, what's really happening, that we're angry or resentful or upset. What happened to me was that as I was doing the mindfulness meditation, going on retreats, at some point there arose in the context of mindfulness practice very strong feelings of loving kindness, very strong feelings of friendliness or of goodwill. And when I recognized it in my own practice that way, kind of rising spontaneously, then the loving kindness practice made a lot of sense to me. And then I had a reference in my own experience of these feelings. And then the loving kindness practice became almost like a reminder to recognize these things that were already in me. I could evoke it quite easily. But until I had those experiences in meditation, I actually avoided loving kindness meditation. When the teachers would do a guided loving kindness meditation like I did for you just now, I would tune them out because I wasn't going to bother with such sentimental things. Now, at the beginning of the meditation, I asked you to pay a little bit of attention to the disposition that you were sitting in, how you were disposed as you sat here, the orientation towards your experience or yourself. And if we pay careful attention to how we're disposed, we'll find that most of us, most of the time, are disposed in a certain direction or have a certain disposition which is operating, often somewhat unconsciously or sometimes quite unconsciously. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to begin showing us the dispositions, the attitudes, the orientations we have towards life or towards ourselves, which are operating and affect the way we live our lives. So, for example, there are some people whose basic attitude towards life, and it might be somewhat unconscious, is that the world is a threatening place, that there's always threats out there. And so, with that kind of orientation, they're always on the defensive, always ready to find danger, always ready to put up their guard. There are other people whose orientation is the world is basically benign, and they're very trusting and maybe naive even sometimes. There's some people who orientation is that when there's uncomfortable situations in life, they always look towards others to find blame. They always look towards the situation to be critical and attack, to be judgmental, often as a way of protecting themselves. And other people who don't criticize externally when there's problems, but rather orientation is they're always disposed to look inward to themselves and be critical towards themselves. Some people have a basic disposition to life that's basically filled with desire. It's all about wanting and getting. The more we get, the more we have, the more experiences we can get, the more validated we feel, the more fulfilled we are. Other people whose basic orientation is one of aversion. They don't want to be left alone. They don't want to be bothered, so they put up. There's many ways in which people are disposed or oriented towards life. And many of these go unexamined. And they can govern how a person lives their life, their whole life, without actually ever being looked at. What Buddhist practice points to is the possibility of living a life which is not disposed in any particular direction, which doesn't have any presuppositions or predispositions as how we meet our experience of life. But we can meet life fresh or new. The expression beginner's mind is sometimes talked about. We meet it fresh and new and just kind of see things in a new way as they are as opposed to seeing them through the filter of our predispositions. Our dispositions, the ones that are unwholesome, the ones that cause us pain and suffering, are not any more or less artificial than this disposition towards friendship and friendliness. However, the disposition towards friendliness is not something that we necessarily do or get created, or is a result of our conditioning in life, but the basic kind of innate or core experience of loving kindness arises when there's no dispositions present, when we're no longer reacting to life, we're no longer orienting ourselves in any particular direction, when the heart and the mind are really open, when there's open-mindedness, open-heartedness present, there's this tenderness of heart, tenderness of mind, this tenderness of being. There's this willingness to let our feelings just kind of flow without inhibiting them in any way. And when we're settled on ourselves, relaxed on ourselves, content in ourselves, the expression of the feeling of goodwill will arise on its own. Some people will wait until it arises on its own. But in Buddhism, there's this practice of loving kindness, which is a practice that basically offers you the possibility of touching into this aspect of your life without having to wait until it comes on its own good time. And it's considered to be a very powerful practice, loving kindness. There are some people who this is their primary meditation practice. Primary spiritual practice is a practice of loving kindness. I've heard about monks in Thailand who would spend 20, 30, 40 years doing only loving kindness meditation. And people would just, when they get into the monastery that person was living in, they just feel this field of loving kindness. It was palpable. You know, people would just go hang out with this person because they just, these waves of goodwill and loving kindness would just kind of be around this person, bubbling up. It's quite powerful practice. And it's powerful because I think it really reflects the capacity that's within each of us, the capacity of goodwill. It's not something foreign that we have to import. Some people try to import it. Some people try to do it artificially, kind of like making positive statements or affirmations or kind of force themselves to feel loving or whatever. And that's not the way loving kindness works. It's not based on trying to have a feeling, but rather it's trying to identify an intention, a wish within yourself of goodwill, whether towards yourself or towards others. And whether you feel loving or not is different than having the wish. But that wish is considered to be, that intention is considered to be a very important part of who we are. And to be respected and honored, it's actually, our intentions are really the heart, one of the core elements of Buddhist spirituality. To somehow understand the power of intentions in our life. And as we do loving kindness practice, as we connect to this intention, it often works as what I call the tenderizer of the heart. And it's kind of like in kind of modern language, we talk about the armor, like the armor of the heart, kind of the crust around the heart begins to soften. And so what's in the heart has a chance to show itself. Now that sounds very nice, right? Except not everyone has love in their hearts. There's often anger and resentment or grief, fear that might be kind of buried in people's hearts. The heart is kind of like an emotional center, holding ground for many people. And so the tenderizing practice of loving kindness will sometimes reveal or bring up feelings of anger or rage or great grief or sadness. And then sometimes people will think, oh, I'm not doing it right. You know, here I was supposed to do this wonderful loving practice and I feel the opposite. I'm a loving kindness failure. But actually, the practice has worked. The function, one of the functions of the practice is to tenderize the crust, so this deeper stuff can come out. So if the opposite of loving kindness comes out, just consider it to be a gift in a sense. It's uncomfortable. And then a person can either switch back to mindfulness practice, or, which is also very interesting, is to begin directing loving kindness to those difficult emotions, or to yourself having those difficult emotions. So anger arises, and you direct the feeling of goodwill, or the attitude of goodwill, the orientation, the intention, to those feelings of anger. And that's very powerful, because many people have very critical attitude towards their anger. Even sometimes when they indulge in it, deep down inside, they might actually be feeling, oh, I'm bad, I'm wrong, this is terrible. And they're at war with themselves. And to have loving kindness towards your anger is, for some people, is a radical shift of perspective. And your anger will notice the difference. Absolutely. How do you think your anger feels being criticized and being ashamed or whatever, judged? It doesn't feel very good. But if you could bring this kindness towards it, it can relax. And what anger most wants to do is to relax, and then has a chance to do something else. Sometimes there does arise feelings of love, feelings of compassion or goodwill when we do loving kindness practice. And then just take that as a gift. But it doesn't necessarily have to happen in order for the loving kindness practice to be successful. It's really what the practice is about, is watering the seed intention of goodwill. And as you water that seed, as you recognize that inside of yourself, if you have maybe just a little sliver of an intention inside of you for your own well-being, for the well-being of someone else, as you recognize that, respect it, nourish it maybe a little bit with the phrases of loving kindness, you strengthen that intention. And maybe nothing happens in the sitting, but you're kind of a little bit then predisposing yourself in the future to encounter a situation that might be difficult, and for the intention of loving kindness to surface. So I've had that situation where, because I do loving kindness practice, I've gone into situations where normally maybe I would have been very critical or very upset at someone. But I remember, oh, loving kindness. I think about this person. Maybe this person here has the capacity of being very different than who they are right now. I'm sure the person isn't always a jerk. And so I look at the person, I begin looking at the person a little bit differently. And I try to find inside of myself, somehow beginning to explore the possibility of wishing loving kindness, wishing happiness on this person. And even if I can't do it, just a little bit kind of explore the possibility, maybe I could, often will change the situation quite dramatically. A place that I'm very fond of doing loving kindness meditation towards others is at the airports, especially if I'm waiting for an airplane and don't have much to do. Because people are usually not, overall, airports are not a happy place. Overall, people are not walking down to catch their plane giggling or laughing or kind of content or, you know, filled with happiness. People in a hurry or grumpy or, I don't know. You've been there, probably most of you, to airports, and know how it is. So I like sitting there in the chair, looking at, you know, doing people watching as people walk by. And I see these faces that look kind of intent or whatever they look in the airports. And I imagine what that face would look like if the person was happy. Like it was the happiest day of their life, you know, how their eyes would be sparkling and their mouth would be smiling and kind of this buoyancy in their voice or in their walk or whatever. And so I kind of try to creatively imagine seeing that in that person. And once I can do that, act of imagination, then it's almost easy to have loving kindness for them, to wish that for them. Since you have that capacity to be that way, may it be so. I wish it could be so. And I have no idea if it's helpful for the people in the airport, but it's helpful for me. And that's really the primary function of loving kindness practice, is to be helpful to you. Some people think of it as more like prayer, that you're trying to affect someone else, you know, sending someone else loving kindness. I think it is effective to do loving kindness towards other people, and I think other people somehow, in some way or other, maybe it's roundabout, will pick that up. But the primary function of doing loving kindness practice is really for yourself. And as we do loving kindness towards others, it begins softening us. It begins strengthening this intention in ourselves. And we begin softening the places of hardness, of resentment, or bitterness, or protectiveness that we often carry around with us a lot. And so we can start being disposed towards life in a new way, in a way that's more helpful for yourself and for others. It's said, classically, loving-kindness practice is always done first towards yourself. And it's been recognized for quite some time now that in America, this maybe isn't so wise. Because a lot of Americans have much more complicated relationships to themselves than ancient Indians did. I don't know if that's true, but what I do know true is that it is difficult for a lot of people here in the West, their own self. And we often have this predisposed to think that something's fundamentally flawed or wrong with us, and we're ashamed who we are, and it's better if no one notices that we exist, and we kind of sneak in and sneak out. So if that's the case, then sometimes it's actually better to start with loving kindness towards someone else. And wish it, you know, find someone who really cares about you. Classically, it's called a benefactor, whether a friend, a relative, or someone, a teacher. And it might be, or a child, you know, or. And see if you can discover some intention for their happiness. And it might be a lot easier then for that other person than for yourself. And then after doing it for the other person for a while, then it might be possible to turn around and do it towards oneself. The idea is eventually to be able to do it also to your enemies. In America, we usually don't use the word enemy, which is the classic Buddhist word. We usually say difficult people. So there's no shortage of difficult people for some of us. And maybe we don't have enemies per se, but. And so the idea is also to discover the capacity to wish difficult people happiness. And that takes some doing. It's a real kind of. You know, it takes some reconfiguring inside sometimes to be able to find that. But it's possible to do that. It's possible to somehow recognize the common humanity in the difficult person and the capacity that a person has for happiness. Perhaps sometimes that loving kindness for a difficult person is arrived at by first having compassion for them. And realizing the difficulties they're going through or the difficulties they have. And then from there, maybe some goodwill can arise. Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, there's a classic sequence for doing your daily meditation practice. Here in the West, we mostly just teach people just do mindfulness meditation. But there's also what can be called setup exercises that people do before they do mindfulness practice. And one of the setup practices is to spend about 5 minutes doing loving kindness practice first, and then do the rest of your session with the regular mindfulness. And part of the reason for that is to help inculcate, help create an attitude of friendliness towards yourself and friendliness towards your experience. So rather than coming with a predisposition of unkindness or unfriendliness towards you and yourself and your experience, we try to at least create a little bit of a field of friendliness. And then it's a lot easier in that field of friendliness to do the mindfulness practice. And especially if we've been busy all day being angry or resentful or whatever, it can be quite significant to spend 5 minutes kind of switching gears by doing some loving kindness practice before doing the mindfulness. So that's plenty of kind of introductory words on the topic. I'd like to hear from you. What was it like to do that meditation? Or what are your concerns or questions about what I've been talking about?
When thinking about difficult people or enemies, I notice the fear in me when I'm trying to do metta practice that I will forget what they've done, or I will, in a desire to kind of to make myself feel better or to feel better about them, I'll just sort of lose the ability to remember. This is what they've done. Don't forget that. And so that's sort of a resistance in not wishing someone else well.
Interesting. I don't know what to say, but it's interesting. Buddhist practice is not meant to be a substitute for common sense. So, and forgiveness, for example, does not mean forgetting what someone has done, and it also doesn't mean forgiveness doesn't mean pardoning what they've done or somehow denying that it happened. It's really fully recognizing what's actually happened and that it was wrong. And that clear recognition that it was wrong, was inappropriate, even then being willing to let go of the resentment and have an open heart or goodwill feeling to that person again. And there's nothing about forgetting in forgiveness. And I don't think loving kindness practice implies anything about forgiveness and forgetting in it. Though I can imagine someone would want to forget, because sometimes we tend to be aversive towards the unpleasant experiences of life. We want to push it away. And so one way we push it away is kind of to forget it. A mindfulness practice supports remembering. The word for remember and mindfulness is basically the same word in Buddhism. And hopefully, if you're mindful, you'll have the wisdom to know how to respond when someone does the same thing over again, to recognize it when it's happening. As mindfulness gets developed, with it comes a sensitivity to inappropriateness. It's a sensitivity, kind of inner sensitivity or wisdom recognition. Oh, this doesn't feel right. Something's wrong here. Something's off here. And as that sensitivity to, oh, something's off here, becomes stronger and stronger, or more familiar to you, then part of the common sense or part of the street smarts that's supposed to develop with practice is then we learn how to stop for that and take that seriously and say, wait a minute, something doesn't feel right here. And then we even say it to the other person, speak it. And as that sensitivity of mindfulness develops, maybe it's less important to remember what the person's done in the past, because you're really attentive and ready to notice and take care of yourself in the present. Make some sense? Yes?
I have trouble with the same thing, almost. That, because I was watching myself too, and it seems almost, just the forgiveness part, the rest of it was okay. And I've had trouble with, I read about these forgiveness projects at Stanford and things, and I don't see how they can work. They interest me because I think it would be very nice to be able to do this, but to me it raises fear. Fear that if I forgive, it's saying that what they did was all right, and it wasn't all right.
Right.
And then I think that I'm lying to myself, and that's not right. And furthermore, if I somehow talk myself into forgiving them, which is a con anyway, then they can do it again. I find it very difficult.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about what forgiveness is. And forgiveness is specifically not pardoning someone or saying what you did was okay.
It's not
saying what you did was okay. There's no implication that what you did, oh, that was okay what you did. That's kind of condoning the experience.
And it's saying you can do it again.
If that's what you're doing, if you're saying it's okay what you did, oh, it's okay, I forgive you, it's okay what you did, you know, then maybe it's easier for them to do it again.
Yeah, that's okay.
But that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is recognizing very clearly that was inappropriate. Well, thank you very much. Forgiveness is recognizing very clearly that the action was inappropriate. And it's in no way saying that it was appropriate. What it's saying is that even though it was inappropriate and it was wrong, I'm not going to hold resentment towards you anymore. And it's very difficult to have forgiveness for someone if they haven't stopped doing what is inappropriate. If they continue to be harming you, I don't know if it makes sense to forgive them. But if the person has stopped doing what they've done, especially if they've apologized, especially if they somehow step aside from it and say, that was wrong, then it makes then you know, you're not saying it's right, you're just saying, I'm no longer going to hold it against you. And then because both parties have recognized it as being wrong, then I think that there's hopefully the wisdom to be attentive to that rising in the future and not be accepting of it. There are some phenomenally powerful examples, I'm sure you've read about, of forgiveness in the world, you know, of all kinds of situations. This principle of the harm has to stop before there can be forgiveness, I learned from reading accounts of people in Guatemala, or no, in Nicaragua. There were all these phenomenal atrocities done there, back and forth on both sides. And when the Sandinista government was overthrown, there was a lot of forgiveness of a lot of the people in the government who had done a lot of atrocities. And people were astounded that the locals could forgive. And
it stopped.
And that was the place. When they were asked, you know, how could you do this? They said, well, we could because it had stopped. But forgiveness is a very important part of life. But it requires some wisdom. You know, we don't want to do it naively. Just forgive, you know, the first chance we have. There has to be really clear, that's why mindfulness is important. There has to be very clear seeing of what our intentions are and what our reactions are and what's really going on. However, there's a little saying, a little bit humorous saying, that also I think is very wise concerning forgiveness. And that is, it defines forgiveness as the giving up of all hope for a better past. So it kind of the wisdom of that is to point to, you know, why is there the holding? Why is there the resentment? What are we holding against when it has to do with the past? Forgiveness doesn't make any sense unless there is resentment. There's no forgiveness without resentment first. So, you know, if you think for forgiveness as being this wonderfully, you know, ideal virtue, I'm going to be a forgiving person. You know, but you have to be resentful before you can forgive. Otherwise, there's no need to forgive. And it's often with a lot of wonderful ideals that we forget only exist in relationship to something which is less than ideal. Compassion is that way. Compassion is a wonderful ideal. It doesn't make any sense to say, oh, I'm going to be a compassionate person in the abstract. Compassion only arises in relationship to suffering. There has to be suffering first for there to be compassion.
And that is a guarantee.
Sorry?
But that is a guarantee. Suffering is a guarantee for everyone in life.
Yes, so there's lots of reasons to have compassion.
Well, continuing on the theme of giving up hope for a better past, I guess this is not, I don't know if there's anything to say about this, but I find my benefactors and my enemies are interchangeable. Mother today, benefactor obviously tomorrow. You know, so that actually having that happen is really wonderful.
Yeah, helpful, I think.
Because we have complex relationships with people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it could be very, very wise to see that, because then at some point in the future there might be an enemy. It's hard to switch, hard to kind of get into there with some kindness, and because you had the experience of the interchangeability so much, you might be willing to give them the benefit of the doubt or kind of look a little bit beyond your walls. Nancy.
I remember reading several years ago an article Sylvia Bornstein had written about metta and her suggestions regarding the difficult person, which for me has been a very difficult thing. And she was saying if the difficult person is that is really intensely difficult, and it doesn't feel genuine or comfortable to be mechanically doing those loving kindness techniques, then to turn it around just to yourself again and send the loving kindness to yourself in deep respect.
Yeah.
I think that's great, because I tried to do this one difficult person and I did not succeed. I just leaped in a way that was very unhealthy, I noticed. And so, yeah.
A couple of things about that. One is that I think it's important to remember that the function of loving kindness practice is just really to help you, yourself. It's not supposed to be for your sake of your enemy. And also, in the same regard, same way, maybe just that you're really doing it for yourself. So if it's not helpful, don't bother. Oh, that's what I was going to say, is that sometimes in the West, some of the people I meet, I've noticed that they tend to see the loving kindness practice through the filter of a certain kind of moral obligation. When we're supposed to be loving people, we're supposed to be forgiving of our enemies, you know, and we're obligated to do it, and something wrong with us if we don't find our worst enemy and do this forgiveness. Buddhism doesn't give us message like that. Buddhism just says, it's good to do some loving kindness meditation, and it's good to do the different categories of people. It's good for yourself, but there's no moral obligation to do it. And if someone is too difficult to do, it just makes you kind of more uptight. Don't bother. You know, you can deal with it later. You'll get opportunities in the future to work on that and do something else for a while.
But I think what happens is sometimes we buy into how noble.
Yeah.
Concept.
It is noble.
It works.
Yes.
And other times it absolutely doesn't.
Right. So that's good. So don't buy into how noble it is. Don't get into some self-righteous stance or some idea of moral obligation. Just take it as a fun thing to do. You know, it should be fun. If it's not fun, don't bother.
Is it okay to forgive and to at the same time have a clear notion that the relationship is not going to be the same? I mean, like,
sure.
With one person I've abbreviated the relationship quite a bit, you know, but I came to a place finally after a bazillion years of stopping the resentment, stopping holding that. And I said that, you know, we had a face-to-face about it. I said, and this is what I no longer feel these feelings for you, but I also am not willing to have a full and complete open relationship with you.
Yeah, I can imagine that. There was a woman many years ago who I had resentment towards. And at some point I was a little bit pleased with myself for letting go of the resentment. Oh, I said, I've forgiven now, everything's fine. And it took me for a while to realize that, in fact, I'd let go of the resentment. But I didn't actually have any open-hearted feeling towards her. My heart didn't really extend towards her with warmth. And maybe the resentment had gotten just very much more subtle. But I basically had become kind of neutral with her. And when I finally realized that, then I was a look at that. And then with time, I discovered that actually I could have a good-willed, good-hearted relationship towards her. But I was never really interested in going back and becoming friends with her, reestablishing the old relationship. It didn't make any sense given what had happened and how I understood who she was and everything. And but I'm glad now that when I see her, I'm actually quite friendly. Though I'm not interested in reestablishing the old relationship. So for me, it was very important to recognize the difference between letting go of resentment and being neutral versus letting go of resentment and having kind of a goodwill feeling towards the person. And that's what we're looking for, in a sense, is to have a goodwill feeling, not just to leave it at being a blank, kind of neutral, neutrality. Adam.
An observation, which is just that it seems like the loving kindness to the difficult person and forgiving someone else, that someone else is often the difficult person. But in my experience, I've seen forgive. A difficult person being the same person that I don't want to forgive. And it's also interesting to me, again, just an observation, that to look at forgiveness first, but a difficult person last in the sequence of things.
That's interesting, yeah. I hadn't thought about that, how that works as a sequence. Yes?
I found myself forgiving just to accept the situation. How do I get to the point of forgiving just to forgive?
What's the difference?
Well, I forgive because I want to be at peace with people.
Uh-huh.
How do I get to the point of forgiving because that's what my nature is? Like, just like forgiving because they make mistakes and because there's no right way to be.
I'm not sure how to answer, just top of my head, but two things occurred to me. One is cultivate a lot of loving kindness. The more loving kindness you have, I think the easier it is to just want to forgive or not hold on to resentment. And the other is cultivate your mindfulness. And I think the more mindful you are, the more that becomes part of your nature to want to do that. You don't have to. So that's not a very good answer, but that's what came to mind. Maybe someone else wants to respond. Yes?
I think it goes back to the intention. If his intention is to forgive, then that's the intention. It doesn't matter how far he gets into the forgiveness. The fact that it's pure intention it can be enough.
That's nice. So the intention is important, listening to you, it sounds like your intention is already there. Maybe appreciate that more rather than your ability to follow through all the way.
I see.
Yes?
And it might be that if you aren't used to forgiving, it doesn't feel natural when you're first doing it.
Right.
And at one point, you'll just wake up and it'll be more natural feeling.
You gave a Dharma talk a couple of years ago where you had looked at how forgiveness doesn't really come out of Buddhism explicitly or something to that effect, how it wasn't explicitly talked about. Or this was my interpretation of it, and at the end of it I really had this feeling that if you just worked on the loving kindness end of things, that would be enough.
Oh yeah, and if you just do mindfulness, that's enough. It's wonderful to have these practices where you just do one of them, and you know everything else follows almost. But it's helpful to combine them. It kind of speeds things up sometimes. Yes.
Of course, mindfulness. In mindfulness, you concentrate on the moment and try not to get stuck in the past or about the future. And I think basically we're talking with forgiveness about a past event, that somebody did something. It's in the past because it's not really going on anymore, but it continues to sort of gnaw at you. And if you practice mindfulness, then you stay in the present and you don't, you know, keep stewing over the past or the future.
To some degree. Also what happens is that if we do mindfulness of the present, and the mindfulness gets very sensitive to what's happening in the present, we learn to identify the holding in the present that has to do with what happened in the past. Because the holding, the suffering and the resentment is not the past. The resentment you're doing in the present. The holding is in the present. And the function of mindfulness is to ferret out the holding that's in the present moment. In that sense, you don't necessarily have to understand the past. What you have to do is understand the holding itself. So mindfulness addresses the issue, very directly, but not by necessarily going back revisiting the past. Does that make sense? Well, that's probably enough. Maybe we'll ask one and then we'll sit.
Yeah, a quick question. For practice purposes, you know, would you do metta first and then mindfulness, or the other way around? Or would it depend upon your particular situation?
It depends on your particular situation and what you think is most fun.
Okay.
You know, most helpful. Classically, the way to do it is mindfulness first. Loving kindness first for a little bit. And then you switch over to mindfulness. But it's really, there's no, you know, right way. It's one of the criteria for deciding is what's helpful for you. So let's sit quietly for a few minutes.